let's just pipe in, as they say, Mary Pat Kelly, somebody we've known for a very long time. And I believe that you're kind of, is your mother still babysitting you? Is that what we hear?
She's right here, yes.
Oh, my God.
We celebrated her 99th birthday last year. So.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's great.
We're counting down to 100.
My God, this is great. Okay, tell her keep going. Mary Pat Kelly. Okay, we don't know where to start in terms of your achievements, but, you know, a screenwriter, you know, an author, a movie producer, you name it. You know, you've been there, you've done that, but can you bring us back to the place you were born and how all of this Irishness came out in you?
I would love to. I was born in Chicago, and I grew up with a great pride in being Irish, but without much connection to Ireland. Most of my family had come over during the Great Starvation, and we didn't really have much sense of the home place where we were from. And I had a funny experience. As you know, my husband, Martin Sheeran, is from County Tyrone. And when I went back after we were married, in like this probably would have been 87, and his aunt was introducing me to everyone as Martin's American wife. And I said, well, you know, Auntie, and I am Irish too. And she said, oh, really? Where's your home place? I said, I don't know. And so she says, here's Martin's American wife. So even though I felt a great connection to my Irishness, it wasn't until I really found where we were from, which I did in connection with writing a trilogy of novels based on my family history, that I understood why being Irish was such an important part of my life and of my family, and that there was a lot more to it than turning the river green on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. I wonder, as I was listening to you there, how many and a great number of people, you know, love to, some wishing to without much proof of their Irish heritage, of their Irish background. And if you can just say, you're a bit cheeky, by the way, if you only had your foot in the door there in Tyrone. That's not a great place to start messing around to begin with.
No, I know. I learned that.
But saying, well, you know, I'm Irish, and then getting caught out so quickly, say, oh, really, where? And what is that feeling when you say, my God, I just got caught here, you know?
Well, I had always had this longing, but I thought it was impossible because they came over like in the 1840s.
Yeah.
But I discovered that, first of all, through the census, the American census, but my big breakthrough was my father had a cousin who lived to be 107, and she was a nun. And so she was born in 1889, and my great-great-grandmother didn't die until 1899. And she was the one that was born in Ireland and brought her children over to Chicago during the Great Starvation. So once I really, actually Martin and I on our honeymoon stopped to see her in Dubuque, Iowa, and I started to ask the questions, and then I was able to realize Galway, and then when they had these family history centers where they started computerized church records. But it's much easier now. People are doing it through DNA and 23andMe and all these things. But I never understood how important it was to me till I actually stood on the piece of Irish ground that did belong to me, which was in Barna, Galway. My great-great-grandmother had been born into a fishing family, and their whole village was burned down on one night during the Great Starvation. They were all evicted. And coming back, I really could feel her spirit. And it was a great experience. And I had done a lot of, you know, we've known each other for a long time. I've got a PhD in Irish studies. I worked with John Hume in Northern Ireland, did documentaries. But it was when I stood on that spot that I really felt that I could claim my Irishness in a way that I hadn't been able to before.
All right. We just wanted to at least touch on, in your own career, working as a screenwriter for Paramount Films and Columbia Pictures, and, you know, being an associate producer of, you know, Good Morning America, Saturday Night Live. What, how did that influence your career, and where was your Irishness coming through there, or did you have to put that on the back burner while you're doing all of this other stuff?
Well, you know, it was interesting because I, as we've talked about before, and I've talked, I studied to be a nun. When I was 17, I entered the convent, and I stayed until I was 23. But I was always interested in film even then. But there were no, it was difficult to study film. There were no real books. But I did find an article about a young film student, and I wrote him a letter. He was at NYU, and he wrote back to me, and we began a correspondence. It was kind of like I had my own correspondence course. And his name is Martin Scorsese. And when I did leave the convent then, in 1968, I guess, I met him in New York, and he said to me, well, if you're still interested in film, you really should go to NYU Film School. But the fascinating thing was I had just come from Ireland, and he was very interested in exploring his own Italian-American roots, because in like 69, 70, people weren't really talking much about their ethnic background. It was much more about being American. And I think because he was so connected to this search for his Italian roots, that I realized that my Irish roots, which were always important to me, that there was a story there that I wanted to tell. And thus began, as you said, in Paramount, I wrote about Ireland and some stories that were set in Ireland. And then finally, with Proud, was able to do a feature film about the only African-American sailors in World War II who came to Ireland and were treated as Americans for the first time in their life. And then over the last 10 years wrote this trilogy of novels, Galway Bay, of Irish Blood and Irish Above All, that actually just went right into the story. But I think it gave me a shape to my life and a sense of belonging and an identity that I was very proud of, but that was a very expansive identity that, first of all, was very positive about all the women heroes that I discovered and the openness to revolutionary ideas. And it's a great, well, I'm not telling you, but it's an incredible heritage, not to mention the fun of the music and the good conversation and all the things that I felt I had entree to by being Irish.
You know, you've mentioned the book, like Galway Bay is like, you know, to Irish America, something that we can maybe compare with what Four Green Fields, you know, to Tommy Makem was. When you're a writer and when you have an award-winning bestseller like Galway Bay, as you move on, you're writing your next novel, your next book, does it dawn on you that maybe, ooh, maybe this isn't going to have the same rate of success appeal as Galway Bay? Just what stirs?
Well, the thing that happened to me was, since I based it on my own family, I became fascinated. First, the heroine of Galway Bay is Honora, my great-great-grandmother.
Yes.
But she had a granddaughter called Nora. And all my life I'd heard about Aunt Noni. She would have been my great-aunt who lived in Paris. And so I became fascinated with her. And when you're writing, it's a very funny experience because you're all alone. It's often with me. It's early in the morning. And these characters start to speak to you. And I am thrilled when readers connect and when they love it and, you know, please God, sell a lot of books. But really, it's that experience of kind of being, well, you must feel it as a musician when you connect to this creative spirit and it works. And it almost doesn't matter what anybody else thinks about it. Mm-hmm. And, 'cause there it is, it comes out. And it's a powerful feeling. Yes, hey, I would hope that people would like it and connect to it. But it's those early morning moments that are, to me, why you do it, why I do it.
Is there a tendency when you are writing and you're focused on, you know, on your story, is it a plus or a minus to take a break and, say, run your draft, say, you know, with Martin, you know, with...
Adrian, you know me too well. That's exactly what I do. When I get stuck, I go in. Now, Martin is a late sleeper, but I'm always waking him up and say, could I read you this bit? Because he has a very good meter for what works and what doesn't work. And he's not shy about telling me. And it really does help. It's funny you mentioned Martin because he's my best feedback, because I know he's not going to sugarcoat it. Because he is Irish, he knows sometimes if I miss the mark a little bit when I'm trying to describe an Irish scene or Irish dialect or something. And, no, it does help to take a break and hear what someone else's reaction to. But I think it's important as a writer, you have to feel that it's someone that's going to be positive, because the worst thing is, I don't like it. No, he never says that. It would be more, I don't understand, or could you explain, or And then when I do hit it, when I maybe rewrite something, I rewrite some sentences 10, 20, 30 times. When I finally hit it, he says, great. Like Agnella, who is this nun, I had asked her about Honorum, what Honora said, and she couldn't, she said they really didn't talk about the pain, but she gave me this one sentence. She said, Honora used to say we wouldn't die, and that annoyed them. And when I heard that sentence, I thought, yep, that's it. So, well, I know, I compare it to, well, what you do, interviewing or playing music, there's times when you just know when you hit it. Mm-hmm. And you do need someone else to kind of bounce it off. But somebody who's going to be positive, who has your best interest. I don't know if I could do some of the things I hear people do, these writers' groups where they attack each other. I think that'd be very difficult.
Yeah. Of course, you're very much a part of the, Irish-American Artists and Writers and Association, you know, where a lot of writers and artists, as one might imagine, do get together and exchange ideas, and in fact do, you know, readings without interruption. What emotions does that conjure when, you know, you're there with fellow writers, producers, and those who have some lifetime experience of writing, and others who are just trying out their first couple of chapters there to a very tough jury. What is that? How does that work?
Well, it's interesting because when I first started out on book tours and everything, Frank McCourt gave me this great advice. He said, when you go out, he said, don't read from the book. He said, tell the stories. They can buy the damn book and read it themselves. And sometimes in situations like you described, like at the salons, I find it easier to kind of give some background, to tell what inspired me, to tell something, because unless you're really a good actress, to read passages can sometimes be difficult. So the best thing about that is there's an audience. So you can feel, are they with you? Are you losing them? And I started out as a teacher, so I am very aware when, mm-hmm. you know, somebody in the back is like writing notes or throwing spitballs or something. So I think the most important thing is, I think we're so blessed to have a community. What I'm doing right now on your show, talking to someone who understands, with an audience that understands. I think of things like Irish America Magazine. Uh-huh. I mean, I started writing there from the very beginning with Patricia Hardy, because you have an audience that you feel is going to be interested, that's going to be responsive, that's not just kind of the cold world out there. And I think that's the atmosphere that at the readings, which we do at the salons, or when you're writing something for the Irish American Magazine, or even this moment with you, I know you're interested. I know you're kind. I know that we'll have a good conversation. Otherwise, I think you can freeze up inside, because it's scary to share your innermost thoughts with people and put them down on paper. So I think we're very, very lucky to have the community that we have.
Absolutely. And I think that's very well known as well. I just want to, you mentioned you're writing for and contributing, to Irish American Magazine, and you're stumbling, as it were. I think that it was a kind of a stumble to come across in your research a topic that hadn't been covered anywhere before, and that is, about the all-black naval ship crew during World War II. One of only two. What was that? Did that stop you in your tracks, as it were?
Stop me in my tracks, because I had already done a documentary about John Hume and the peace process in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And when I would show that documentary, it was on PBS, people would say, well, that's not Northern Ireland, is it? Because the landscape was so beautiful and the people and the music. I go, yes. So I was always trying to find a way, and this was in the 80s, to present Northern Ireland in a more nuanced way so that people could really see how beautiful it is and the people how good. And so when I was doing, as you said, a research for an article for Irish America magazine, and I discovered the story, and I had found these clippings from an African-American newspaper, this big headline, Irish first to treat USS Mason crew as Americans. And it was about their visit to Northern Ireland and the first time that they really felt like Americans. And I thought, now that's a story about the hospitality of Irish people, about the openness, and also about the 300,000 Americans that were stationed in Northern Ireland during World War II would really be a good story to tell. And Trish Hardy was always so fantastic about encouraging further research and giving me space in the magazine. And it became quite a journey for me that turned into a documentary. And then I found one of the veterans that had been on the ship. So this is in the early 90s. So they were in their 70s, which, as we know, is a young, hearty age.
Yeah.
And I called this one James Graham, and I explained that I was doing a documentary. And he said, I've been waiting 50 years for this phone call, because he'd been trying to get the information out, including the fact that they had been recommended for honors that they never got. So all of a sudden, and I said, well, when could I meet some of the men? And he said, how about tomorrow? And so you remember Maybeth Fenton from the Northern Ireland Tourist Board?
Yeah,
we all went to her apartment the next day and started filming. And they became part of a documentary called Home Away from Home, for which Phil Coulter wrote the theme song, which has gone on now to be quite a popular song.
Absolutely.
Our community, people, you do something, Maybeth, Trish, Phil, people reach out and connect and help tell the story. And Tommy Hilfiger became fascinated with the story, and ultimately he financed a feature film based on the story. So, I mean, much of my life has been through providence or serendipity, whatever you call it. But that's what I say about our community. People are there to encourage you and to help you and to tell the story. And in fact, the Northern Ireland Tourist Board sponsored a trip back for the men in 1995. And as luck would have it, Queen Elizabeth was there. So they met the Queen, and even more amazingly, spent the last night of our trip in a sing-song overnight with Van Morrison.
Mm.
So, Adrian, once you step out, there's no telling what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Now, let's just start with 300,000 American troops in Northern Ireland. It's now World War II. Where were they, and were they scattered throughout Northern Ireland?
They were. There was a big concentration in Derry. This was interesting. 6 months before Pearl Harbor, all these Americans showed up in Derry and started to build this naval base, all in civilian clothes. As soon as Pearl Harbor happened, they all were in uniform. The Navy was secretly building a base because they knew that we were going to get into the war, and they needed a place for a home port for the ships that were going to be escorting the convoys across the Atlantic. So that was going on. Then in January of 1942, right after, a month after Pearl Harbor, the first expeditionary force set off and they landed in Belfast. The idea would be they would train for the invasion of Europe. So they were all throughout the country. Some were in Carrickmore, Martin's town, and yeah. It was an African-American group that was there. And the village all of a sudden was booming. Every house became a pub or a restaurant. The shed was a dance hall. And they were doing great until some white soldiers came to town and objected to how well the black soldiers were being treated. And there was a big fight in the streets. The next day, in every one of those little pubs and restaurants in the dance shed, there was a big sign, "No whites allowed."
Wow.
So I loved that story. Martin told me that story. And believe it or not, Adrian, I met this Marine general, African-American, who was asking me how I got involved in all this military history. And I started to tell him the story. His father had been in Carrickmore during World War II. So it had a huge impact on these people. 300,000, I mean, that's a lot. Probably there were only 1 million people in Northern Ireland at the time. So, and the Marines were there. We don't think of the U.S. Marines involved in Europe during World War II, but they were in Derry, and they were billeted at Beech Hill House, which is now a wonderful hotel, and we put up a little museum there. So I just felt that the Troubles had taken up so much space in the image of Northern Ireland that it was good to go back to a time when there was a different connection with America and the hospitality and the competence. In Derry, they had a shipyard and a hospital that repaired the ships. I mean, it was amazing. There was one military historian that said the skill of the people of Derry probably shortened the war by a year, because they could repair those ships. They made all kinds of medical advances, treating wounds and hypothermia. So it's a great story. And the fact that when I started, there were veterans around that had still participated. Darby's Rangers were founded in Carrickfergus. So a lot of wonderful stories and people that had had a great experience of Northern Ireland, of the people of Northern Ireland, and never forgot it. And the Mason crew, I mean, they told me, different veterans, that it changed their way of how they felt about themselves. As one man said, we were Yanks, and it felt good.
Yeah. Now, of course, the USS Mason, it was really created kind of as an experiment. And that did mark the first time that African Americans were entrusted with position of prominence. Up until that point, you know, they were indeed treated, given the menial jobs. And,
exactly.
Wow, have we carried that tradition forward with multi-ethnic groups? But this was going to be, for all intents and purposes, this was going to be an experiment to see if all the blacks could, in fact, pull something off, and if not, well, what the hell, we won't bother doing that again. I mean, that's as crude a reality as you can make.
Absolutely, Adrian, and you hit the nail on the head, because there were plenty of people that hoped it would fail. Because there was a lot of very sophisticated equipment. I mean, Einstein had invented Doppler and radar and all these sophisticated machinery. And the given wisdom was in the Navy. And I found papers that were written about this that, African Americans could never, they don't have the smarts. Interestingly enough, when they were in training, because there were some among the African American sailors, many had not even graduated from high school, but there were some college educated people, men, that would tutor the rest. They got higher scores on their tests than the white sailors, but the Navy was so incredulous, they made them take the exam again. And of course, they scored even better. But you're absolutely right. It was an experiment, and there were plenty of people that hoped that it would fail. And I always, the veterans said that they really felt a responsibility to succeed. And then in 1948, when Harry Truman integrated the services, especially the Navy, because it was close quarters, it was on ships, there was a lot of resistance. The USS Mason veterans felt that by their success, by them doing so well, that that had helped spur integration of the armed forces. And now, actually, the armed forces are the most integrated part of society. And women, too. The Navy named a new ship, the USS Mason. They came to Ireland in 2016. 60% of the crew was female. So, I mean, ironically, the most segregated part of our society now has become the most integrated, and you can really go forward on merit in ways that there's still parts of our society you can't. So it was an experiment, and thank God it succeeded, because it had huge ramifications.
Yeah, but also, though, okay, the Mason, the USS Mason, its primary purpose, though, was, you know, to escort envoys across the North Atlantic. Was it considered to be a premier? This was a battleship, watch out for them, or were they watching out as kind of bodyguards for you know, the rest of the fleet?
Very much bodyguards. And those ships, they were the destroyer escorts, as you say, were constructed in 90 days. So you can imagine. And the men were told they were the bodyguards. That's actually a very good way to put it. And if it were, and because they were escorting troop ships that would have 10,000 men on them, and they had 160 men. So if a torpedo came, if the only way to save the big ships was to put yourself in the path of the torpedo, that's what they were expected to do. Now, there were ways of evading the torpedo, and they had depth charges and all kinds of sophisticated weapons that they then employed to protect the ships. But it was a duty where you put yourself in harm's way if that's what was necessary.
Yeah, and obviously they knew that. They weren't pulling anything off. Those who found themselves, you know, on the USS Mason, they would have to know that they would be the first to get hit, as it were. You know, it was...
Yes, they did. They talk about that. But, you know, they were young, and they were confident. They were so eager to show what they could do. And it worked. The destroyer escorts, and they did turn the tide against the U-boats. But they knew. They knew what was happening. And in the African-American community, they had this thing called the double V. The idea was victory in the war and then victory at home. That if you were valiant and did your job and showed what good citizens you were, that it meant change things in the United States. And many of the civil rights leaders did come from people that were involved in World War II. So, but it you know, I think, you know, we were talking about my mom. In my latest book, Irish Above All, my father was a Navy flyer, and my mom was 23 years old and said goodbye to him and never knew if she'd ever see him again. And, I mean, I think the whole country was caught up in this moment. And I think probably, like everything else, you hope for the best, but there was always a sense that it could be different.
Now, my guest friends, say, celebrated author, film screenwriter, filmmaker, I just want to ask you, though, about that period, World War, here we're going, was there a draft system? Was that a compulsory? Were there those who were joining because, you know, they pulled the shortest straw or the longest straw? How did that work
yes,
at that time?
There was a draft. Now, the Navy was volunteer and the Marines were volunteer, but it was volunteering knowing that you could be drafted. Interestingly, right. Some of the men, if you were married, if you had a child, there were all kinds of deferments, and some of the men that enlisted in the Navy really didn't have to because they wouldn't have been drafted. But yes, there was a draft, and it was the whole country. I mean, all the men. So if you chose the Navy, one of the men said he thought the Navy would be better because you wouldn't be sleeping outside in the tent. He'd already done that with the CCC. So there were a lot of reasons. It wasn't all, heroism. A lot of it was, we're going to be, we won't be marching. We'll be on a ship. But, of course, if you get hit by a torpedo, then
right.
All bets were off.
But those who got married, and again, at quite young age, would they have had an inkling their life partner would indeed be either drafted, and would they have felt that, by the way, would there be a conversation that says, by the way, if you get drafted, that's one thing, but you're not going to go and volunteer, for the Army? What was that?
I can only take from my own family. I know my dad, after Pearl Harbor, there was this feeling that people, he immediately went and enlisted. I think there was this great sense of our country had been attacked and we have to go out there now. What the life partners, what the women. It's interesting. When I was doing the research, the crazy things you find out, that Valentine, the reason why Valentine was martyred was he was a priest who was marrying the Roman soldiers to their wives, and Roman soldiers were not allowed to be married because the idea was if you had a wife, mm-hmm. you wouldn't fight as hard for the emperor. And so that's why he became the patron saint of love. But I'm sure there were plenty of people that said, no, don't put your life in danger. But it's that that sense of patriotism and war. And, it was I think it probably was the last time that the whole country felt that it was necessary. It was something that you had to do, and you did it. But I agree with you, Adrian. If I had been my mom, then I might have thought, you want to wait a little bit? Let's see what's going to happen. But
right.
Thank God, that
becomes,
he came home safely.
Yeah. But then at that point, it becomes, a decision that's going to affect your family, the future of your family. And, at the rate, a lot of those who were drafted or volunteered, the outlook wasn't that great. It was, flipping a coin at a time like that would take a lot of patriotism. I want to ask you, I do want to talk obviously about the film, the feature film Proud. But before that, Irish Above All is now in paperback, and it again maybe overshadowed by, say, Galway Bay that shows up. It'll be, we just about in any Irish circle we go to. And traveling, you see Galway Bay there. So tell us about Irish Above All and what is, poignant about that novel, that book.
Well, my Honora's grandson, Ed Kelly, became the mayor of Chicago in a very dramatic way. The mayor of Chicago, a man called Anton Cermak in 1933, was in Miami with Franklin Roosevelt trying to get some money for the city of Chicago, an assassin shot, missed Franklin Roosevelt by an inch, hit Mayor Cermak. He died. They appointed Ed Kelly to take his place, just to be a placeholder. But Ed Kelly became very popular and was elected two or three more times. For me, the poignancy came. He was very friendly with Joseph Kennedy. And when my father came back from the war, he said to Ed Kelly that he'd like to go into politics. And Ed Kelly discouraged him. He said, it's a dirty business, Mike. It's tough. Then I'm thinking of Joseph Kennedy, that when his son wanted to go into politics, or even if he didn't want to, he encouraged him to. So I think it's very poignant, and that's a good word, to see the Irish America now coming into success. But what do they choose? Politics was the way to get ahead. But how could anyone ever have known that it would put, you know, JFK in such And I wrote about him. I put in Irish above all. People know about when he went to Ireland as president, but he had also gone to Ireland right after he got out of the Navy and had a very interesting experience. So I kind of see Irish above all as the Irish Americans kind of coming into their own. But then it wasn't as simple anymore. They had power. They had responsibilities. What happened? And my great aunt was part of all that, and she was a photographer, so she was recording it. So I felt that, and then I think for us as Irish Americans, it's important to really look at our history and to realize the struggles and what happened when they started to get power, how they handled it, what they did. And then against it all is, of course, the love stories and the women trying to hold their families together. And sometimes success can be as difficult to take as poverty, you know.
And of course, what does make, you know, for a good book and for a good film, you know, generally that impression, you know, that as far back as we would like to go, here were the Irish who were drinkers and fighters and lacked any kind of refinement or education or something. That breakthrough, would you say that was because of in terms of reversing that image, would that have been because of the Irish and Irish Americans, say, politicians, and are breaking in through that door?
Definitely, I think. And education and wanting their sons and daughters. And so many of those images that you, I was just reading this book about vaudeville, and so many of those images were stereotypes that were presented of the Irish that weren't really true. But it was difficult to get out of the stereotype. And I think in your own family, I mean, they were gentlemen. They were educated. They spoke well. I mean, the image of the Irish was never true, really, but you had to kind of break through and get out, and so that people could see who you were. I mean, they're showing, there's an ad, I think, for Bloomberg where he has John Kennedy's speech. I mean, when you listen to him and what he, the eloquence and that, and the educators and the poets and the writers. I mean, it's an amazing story, and it was hard to get away from the stereotypes.
Yeah. Come back to, if you will, this showing of the feature film, your dramatic feature film, Proud, and it is the story of one of the only two U.S. naval ships that saw combat in World War II with African-American crews. Tell us about taking that from your research for Irish American Magazine and bringing it, you know, again to the screen, to film. Were film makers saying, excuse me, why don't you stick with the Irish stuff?
It's interesting. The veterans really, I said to them, well, don't you want, you know, somebody black to do this? Don't you want a naval historian? But they had talked to other people, and they kind of wanted it done. Mm. So first it was the documentary, and then it was 9/11 that really changed things for telling the story, because Tommy Hilfiger had been interested in the story. He'd met some of the veterans. But after 9/11, he said, we really need our heroes. And he felt a feature film, a dramatic film, had a better chance of reaching young people. And Ossie Davis, the great Ossie Davis, had narrated the documentary and was willing to be part of the feature film. And so was Stephen Ray.
Yeah.
So I always loved I always loved to imagine the veterans in Ireland. And now, through the feature film, we could actually show it, including having them greeted on the walls of Derry by a professor who was played by John Hume. So I was able to get a lot of the things that I love into the movie. And, of course, the beautiful countryside. And the three young actors that came over, there's a scene where they just run across a beautiful green field and the music is swelling. And they said they felt a freedom doing that they really had never felt. In other words, they had the experience in, 2002 that the veterans had had in 1944. So something about the big screen and a feature film that does it's a communal experience in a way that nothing else is, I think. So I was really happy. But it was a risk. I mean, we showed it at the Apollo Theater. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, the Apollo has a reputation. But the audience loved it. And there's a scene where some white dock workers try to board the ship because they're against the black sailors. And the captain calls battle stations. So you see the guns turning on these white dock workers, and then they back down. But from the audience of the Apollo, people shouted out, shoot them anyway. So it was a great experience. And I'm delighted Kieran Madden, the consul general, has a great interest in looking at the Irish American experience in all its forms. And there's a whole connection with the African American experience, not only through the Mason veterans, but as we were talking about 23andMe, people are finding out that they have Irish ancestors and are interested in making the connection. So I'm delighted that it's going to be shown at the consulate, and I'm so happy that it, and it became a way of bringing attention for the Navy. After we started doing the films, the Navy decided to award the honors that had been delayed and named a new ship, the USS Mason. And it was always a little difficult for the Mason veterans because the Tuskegee Airmen were the ones that got all the attention.
Yeah.
But as one of the veterans said, well, they might be more famous, but we have a $1 billion warship that's going around the world telling our story. So
the story, again, and I do want to let our listeners know that there are a few, not that many, seats and available to see this movie. It is being hosted at the Irish Consulate, and indeed through the graces of Kieran Madden, the Consul General of Ireland in New York. How do we go? Now, you don't just show up for this one. You need to register. And I am sure that there are some, listeners who say, well, that's a long shot. No, it's not at this point. But how?
No, try. And call. You can call the consulate or, you know, usually if you show up, we'll find room for you.
Okay.
And also, it is on, you can get it from Amazon. You can get it from iTunes. I mean, it's out there if somebody wants to just stream it and watch it at home. But you're right, Adrian. There's not a lot of spaces, but there are some.
Okay. And I'd like to differ with you, which if you show up, that is not really going to work.
Yes,
because you will obviously It is consulate, and you are going to need some, you know, you're going to need identification.
Right. The best thing to do would be to call them or email.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or you can email me, kellymarypat@yahoo.com, and I could forward you the information. And the you do have to register. You're right, Adrian.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Again, it's a golden, really, it's an opportunity. And it's a great story, and how appropriate for this, you know, to be shown in Black History Month here. Congratulations. We look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you, Adrian. This was a lovely conversation. And thank you for all you do to create our community. Really, I can tell you, as somebody who's trying to speak to the community, to have a megaphone like you is fantastic. Thank you. And to Anya Sheridan, who's your right hand. Thank you very much.
What do you mean, my right hand? That's my boss. Okay.
Well, I wanted you to say it, not me.
Okay. Our best to your husband, Martin, there. Okay. Friends, it's time to wrap up the program. And